The Devil's Arithmetic, Disc 5.
Chapter 16. The first choosing had been the hardest, Hannah thought later. After that, it merely became part of the routine. And if you didn't stand too near the Greeks, or work too slowly, or say the wrong word, or speak too loudly, or annoy a guard, or threaten the Blokova, or stumble badly, or fall ill, the chances were that this time you wouldn't be chosen. This time. Part of her revolted against the insanity of the rules. Part of her was grateful. In a world of chaos, any guidelines helped. And she knew that each day she remained alive, she remained alive. One plus one plus one. The Devil's Arithmetic, Gittle called it. And so, one day eroded into the next. Her memories became camp memories only. The day a guard gave her a piece of sausage and asked for nothing in return. The morning a new shipment of tsugangi arrived. The morning a new shipment didn't arrive. The afternoon Gittel organized a rope, and the children all played jumping games after dinner. And that same night, when red-headed Masha from Krakow hanged herself with the jump rope, having learned that her husband and 17-year-old son had gone up the smokestack. It was on a sunny afternoon, as Hannah cleaned out cauldrons with Chiffre, that Hannah asked dreamily, "What's your favorite food, if you could have anything in the world?" They were in the tipped-over pots on their hands and knees, scraping off bits of burnt potato that still clung stubbornly to the vast pot bottom. Chiffre backed out of the cauldron, wiping one dirty hand across her cheek. She thought a moment before answering. It wasn't a new question. They'd been asking each other variations of the same thing for weeks. "An orange, I think," she said slowly. That was a change. Usually she said an egg. "An orange," Hannah echoed, pleased with the novelty. "I'd forgotten oranges. Or an egg. Boiled? Or fried?" They were back to their regular conversation. "Or scrambled? Or an omelet?" "How about pizza?" Hannah said suddenly. "What's pizza?" Chiffre asked. It's... I don't know," Hannah said miserably, fingers in her mouth, blurring the words. "I can't remember. I can only remember potato soup."
"You can remember eggs," Chiffre said.
"No, I can't. Not pizza. Not eggs either. Only potato soup and hard brown bread. That's all I can remember."
She popped a piece of the burned potato scraping into her mouth. "Well, don't cry over this pizza. Tell me about it."
"I can't," Hannah said. "And I'm not crying over the thing, whatever it is. I'm crying because I can't remember what it is. I can't remember anything."
"You can remember the shtetl," Chiffre said. "And Lublin?"
"That's the trouble," said Hannah. "I can't."
Just then, Rivka came out of the kitchen and shook her finger at Hannah. "No tears," she said. "If the Blokova sees you crying..." "That three-fingered bi..." Hannah stopped herself in time. It was a dangerous habit to fall into, calling the Blokova names. One might be chosen for doing such a thing. "If she loses control of her tsugangi, she will be a two-fingered, whatever you call her," said Rivka, smiling.
"What do you mean?"
Hannah and Chiffre asked together. "How do you think she lost those other fingers?"
Hannah mused. "I thought maybe she'd been born that way."
Holding up her own hand and wriggling the fingers, Rivka pointed to one.
"She lost control, and a whole group of tsugangi rioted. That was right before I got here.
They were sent through Lilith's cave, and she lost one finger. Then she lost control, and 6 Tsugangi hanged themselves one night. My Aunt Sarah among them. Aunt Sarah had been sick for a long time and could no longer disguise it. She knew she was to be sent to the hospital. Everyone really sick in the hospital goes up the stack. So she said to my mother, I will do the choosing, not them. God will understand. Rivka smiled. A second finger. I wish Aunt Sarah could have seen the Blokova's face in the morning when they took the finger. Maybe we could do something to help the Blokova balance her hand. 3 is such an unlucky number, Shifra said. Rivka shook her head. Too dangerous, she said. Let the grown-ups make their plans. What plans? Asked Hannah. Oh, Rivka said mysteriously. There are always grown-up plans. What plans? Hannah and Shifra asked together. But before Rivka could answer, a shout from the gate end of the compound riveted them. Commandant! But he was just through yesterday, Hannah said in a nervous whisper. He's not due for at least another few days. Ignoring her, Rivka already had her hands to her mouth, making the clucking sound to warn the children. Shifra, too, was signaling. It's not fair, Hannah complained, her voice rising into a whine. Shifra nudged her angrily, and Hannah began to cluck as the little ones scrambled for the midden pile. The first 2 in were a brother and a sister, 7 and 8 years old. They left green and blue shorts and shirts at the edge of the dump. Next came a 9-year-old girl carrying a baby. She shucked off her shoes as she ran and, holding the baby under one arm, tore off its shirt. When she set the naked baby down by the side of the pile in order to get out of her own dress, the child immediately began crawling toward the midden on its own. Like spawning fish, the children came from everywhere to dive into the pile. They waded or crept in one after another, while the horrible clucking continued, and overhead, the swallows, alerted to a feast of insects, dipped and soared. Hannah finally heard the commandant's car, then saw it as it barreled toward them, down the long bare avenue between the barracks. It moved relentlessly toward the hospital, which squatted at the compound's end. The car had just passed the Tsugangi barracks when the hospital door opened, and a small, thin boy limped down the steps, his right knee bloody and his blue eyes ringed with dirt. He was wiping his hands on his shirt. When he looked up and saw the car bearing down on him, despite the desperate clucking from all around, he froze, staring. Reuven! Hannah cried out. Run! Run to the midden! But the boy didn't move, and she felt a sudden coldness strike through her as if an ice dagger had been plunged into her belly. Got in you, Rivka whispered. Shifra, who'd been looking at the midden with its bright flags of clothing, heard Hannah's shout and turned. She grabbed Hannah's hand, squeezing it until there was no feeling left. The car slowed, then stopped. Commandant Breuer himself got out of the car. He walked toward Reuven, and the child couldn't look at him, staring instead at Hannah, his hand outstretched toward her. Big tears ran down his cheeks, but he cried without a sound. He knows, Hannah whispered. Hush, Rivka said. The commandant looked down at the boy. Have you hurt yourself, my child? He asked, his voice deadly soft. Hannah moved forward a half step, and Rivka jerked her back. Let me see, Breuer said. He took a white handkerchief out of his pocket and touched it to Reuven's bloody knee thoughtfully. And where is your mother? When Reuven didn't answer, Hannah stepped forward. Please, sir, his mother is dead. Rivka gasped.
Hannah heard her and added hastily, "She died years ago when he was born." The commandant stood up and stared at her, his eyes gray and unreadable. "Are you his sister?" She shook her head dumbly, afraid to say more. "That is good for you." Boya bent down and wrapped the handkerchief around the boy's knee, knotting it gently with firm, practiced hands. Then he picked Ruvain up. "A boy your age should be with his mother," he said, smiling. "So I shall be sure you go to her." He handed Ruvain to his driver, who was waiting by the car door. Then, without another word, Boya went up the stairs to the hospital and closed the door so quietly they couldn't tell when it was finally shut. That evening, the sky was red and black with the fire and smoke. The latest arrivals in the cattle cars hadn't been placed in barracks. The camp was full. The newcomers had been shipped directly to processing, a change in routine that frightened even the long-termers. Rumors swept the camp. "A shipment from Holland," some said. "A shipment from Silesia." No one knew for sure. But Reuven did not come back. Not that evening, not that night. "Not ever," Hannah muttered to herself as she watched the smoke curling up, writing its long numbers against the stone-colored sky. "And it's my fault." "Why is it your fault?" Rivka asked. "I should have said he was my brother." "Then you wouldn't be here either. It wouldn't have helped Ruvain." "He's dead," Hannah said the word aloud, curiously, as if understanding it for the first time. "Dead. Do not say that word." "Monsters," Hannah said suddenly. "Gittel is right. We're all monsters." "We are the victims," Rivka said. "They are the monsters. We're all monsters," Hannah said, "because we're letting it happen." She said it not as if she believed it, but as if she were repeating something she'd heard. "God is letting it happen," Rivka said. "But there is a reason. We can't see it yet. Like the binding of Isaac. My father always said that the universe is a great circle, and we only see a small piece of the ark. God is no monster, whatever you think now. There is a reason." Hannah scuffed the ground with her foot. "We should fight," she said. "We should go down fighting." Rivka smiled sadly. "What would we fight with?" "With guns." "We have no guns." "With knives." "Where are our knives?" With something." Rivka put her arm around Hannah's shoulder. "Come, there's more work to be done." "Work is not fighting. You want to be a hero? Like Joshua at Jericho? Like Samson against the Philistines?" She smiled again. "I want to be a hero like..." Hannah thought a minute, but she could think of no one. "Who?" "I don't know. My mother said, before she died, that it's much harder to live this way and to die this way than to go out shooting. Much harder." "Chaya, you are a hero. I'm a hero." Rivka stared for a moment at the sky and the curling smoke. "We're all heroes here." That night, Fega began to speak, as if the words so long dammed up had risen to flood. She told a story she'd heard from her father about the great Baal Shem Tov. It was set in the time when he was a boy named Israel, and his father warned him, "Know, my son, that the enemy will always be with you. He will be in the shadow of your dreams and in your living flesh, for he is the other part of yourself." There will be times when he will surround you with walls of darkness. But remember always that your soul is secure to you, for your soul is entire, and that he cannot enter your soul, for your soul is part of God. Fagin's voice rose and fell as she told how young Israel led a small band of children against a werewolf whose heart was Satan's. And in the end, when Israel walked straight into the werewolf's body and held its awful dark heart in his hand, shivering and jerking like a fish out of water, Fagin said, her own hand moving in the same way, that awful heart was filled with immeasurable pain. A pain that began before time and would endure forever. She whispered the story as the night enfolded them. Then Israel took pity on the heart and gave it freedom. He placed it upon the earth, and the earth opened and swallowed the black heart into itself. A sigh ran around the barrack, and Hannah's was the deepest of all. A werewolf, she thought. That's where we are now, in the belly of the werewolf. But where is its dark, pain-filled heart? She was still sighing when she slipped into sleep. Chapter 17. There is a plan, Gittel whispered, and Yitzchak and Shmuel are part of it. She had crept onto the sleeping shelf, putting her arms around Hannah and speaking very softly into her ear. You must not be afraid, but you must not tell anyone. I am a part of it too. Hannah didn't move. Gittel's voice tickled her ear. The reason I am telling you this is that you are our only flesh and blood, our only link with the past. If something happens to us, you must remember. Promise me, Chaya, you will remember. Hannah's lips moved, but no sound came out. Promise. I will remember. The words forced themselves out through her stiffened lips. Good. What plan? Hannah managed to ask. If I tell you, you might say. Never! You wouldn't mean to, but it could slip out. Not even if I feel... I feel brennen und bruten. Even if you should be burned and roasted. Here, that is not a proverb to be spoken aloud. Horrified at what she'd said, Hannah felt herself begin to giggle. It was a hysterical reaction, but she couldn't seem to control herself. Nevertheless, Gittel ended, I will not tell you. When? Hannah whispered. You'll know. The horn signaled morning roll call, and Gittel rolled off the shelf. Hannah followed, stood, and stared at her. Is it because of Reuven? She asked quietly. For Yitzchak it is. Who else does he have left, poor man? He adored those children, Gittel said. But why you? Why Shmuel? If not us, who? If not now, when? Gittel smiled. I think I've heard those words before, Hannah said slowly. You will hear them again, Gittel promised. Now, we must not talk about this anymore. And yet, for all of Gittel's promises, nothing seemed to happen. The day's routines were as before, the only change being the constant redness of the sky as trainloads of nameless tsugangi were shipped along the rails of death. Still, the camp seemed curiously lightened because of it, as if everyone knew that as long as others were processed, they would not be. A simple bit of mathematics like subtraction, where one taken away from the top line becomes one added on to the bottom. The devil's arithmetic. When? She whispered at night to Gittel. You'll know, Gittel always answered. You'll know. And yet, when it finally happened, Hannah was surprised that she hadn't known, hadn't even suspected. There'd been no signs or portents, no secret signals, just an ordinary day in the camp. And at night she went to bed on the hard, coverless shelf, trying to remember sheets and pillows and quilts. While all around her in the black barrack, she heard the breathy sounds of sleeping women. A hand on her back and over her mouth startled her so she was too surprised to protest.
Chaya, it's now,
Gittel's voice whispered in her ear.
Nod if you understand.
She nodded, opening her eyes wide, though it was too dark to see anything.
The plan, she said,
her words hot on Gittel's palm. She sat up abruptly and just missed smacking her head on the upper shelf. Gittel took her hand away.
Follow me, she whispered. Am I part of the plan? Of course, child. Did you think we would leave you in this hell?
They crept to the door, and Hannah could feel her heart thudding madly. It was warm in the barrack, yet she felt cold.
Here,
Gittel whispered, shoving something into her hands. Hannah looked down. She could see nothing in the dark, but she realized she was holding a pair of shoes.
We'll put them on outside.
They paused at the door, then Gittel eased it open slowly. It protested mildly.
It's not locked, Hannah said, shocked. Some guards can be bribed, Gittel whispered. Give me your hand.
Slipping her hand into Gittel's, Hannah held back for a moment.
What about Fager? Schmuel wouldn't go without Fager.
Gittel's hand on hers tightened.
Fager says she prefers the dark wolf she knows to the dark one she doesn't.
Even with Schmuel going?
But she loves him.
She has come to love her next bowl of soup more, Gittel said.
Now hush.
They slipped through the door, shut it, and locked it from the outside with a too loud snick. Hannah shivered at the sound and took Gittel's hand again, ice on ice.
We meet behind the midden, Gittel whispered. No more talking now.
Hannah looked up. There was no moon. Above them in the cloudless sky, stars were scattered as thick as sand. A small warm breeze blew across the compound. Night insects chirruped. Hannah took a deep breath. The air was sweet-smelling, fresh, new. A dog barked suddenly, and a harsh voice quieted it with a command. Gittel pulled Hannah back against the barracks wall. Hannah could feel the fear threatening to scream out of her, so she dropped the shoes and put both hands over her mouth, effectively gagging herself. There was a wetness under her arms, between her legs, down her back. She moaned. And then there came a shout.
A shot. And another, rumbling, staccato.
A man began to scream, high-pitched and horrible. He called a single phrase over and over and over.
Rabboina shaloylem! Quickly, Gittel whispered hoarsely. It is ruined! Before the lights! Come!
As she spoke, great spotlights raked the compound, missing them by inches and seeking the outer perimeter of wire fence and minefields and the woods beyond, where Hannah thought she saw shadows chasing shadows into the dark trees. Gittel dragged her back to the barracks door, slid the bolt open with one hand, and shoved Hannah inside with the other. They both sank gratefully to the floor.
What is it?
The Blokova's voice called out from her private room. Hannah's mouth opened.
What could they say? They'd be found out.
They would be chosen.
I went to get my bowl to relieve myself, Gittel called, her voice incredibly calm. And then shots began outside, and I was so frightened, I fell to the floor, dropping the bowl.
She pushed Hannah away from her as she spoke. Crawling on her hands and knees, Hannah made it back across the room to her sleeping shelf. She lifted herself onto it gratefully, trembling so hard she was sure she would wake everyone.
You Jews, the Blokova's voice drawled sleepily. You can never do anything quietly or efficiently. That is why the Germans will finish you all off. If you have to relieve yourself, wait until the morning or do it in your bed, or you shall have to deal with me.
Yes, Blokova, Gittel answered.
And get to bed, the Blokova added unnecessarily. Instead of going to her own shelf, Gittel crowded in with Hannah, hugging her so tightly that Hannah could hardly breathe. Yet she was glad not to have to lie there alone. Leaning back against Gittel, Hannah could feel the woman shaking with silent sobs. Then a sudden, awful thought came to her. She couldn't turn over with Gittel there on the shelf, so she whispered to the wall, "Gittel, Gittel, please." At last Gittel heard.
"What is it?" "The shoes, Gittel. I dropped the shoes outside. They'll know it was me out there. What will I do? What will I do?"
"Do?" The breathy voice whispered into her ear.
"Do? Why, you will do nothing, my darling child. Those were not your shoes. They were the Blokovas. I took them from outside her door because you deserved a better pair for such a difficult journey. They will discover her shoes in the morning."
She began to laugh, muffling it against Hannah's back, a sound so close to sobbing that Hannah couldn't tell the difference. Chapter 18. The roll call in the morning was held under a brilliant sun and a sky so blue it hurt the eyes. The woods on the other side of the barbed wire fence burst with birdsong. Commandant Boya himself stood at the front of the assembly, flanked by SS guards. Before him were six men in chains. Hannah recognized only Schmuel and the violin player from the Klezmer band. The other four men were strangers to her. They'd all been badly beaten, and two could not stand.
"Yitzhak," she whispered.
Beside her, Gittel was silent.
"Yitzhak,"
she tried again.
"Hush."
The commandant stared around the compound as if his mind were on other matters. Once he even looked up at the sky. At last he turned his attention to Schmuel, who stood, chin thrust out defiantly. Schmuel spat. A guard hit him with the butt end of his gun in the stomach, and Schmuel went down on his knees, but he made no sound. "These men," Breuer began, "these pieces of, in your Jew language, dreck, tried to escape last night." "Escape? And where would they go? To the minefields? To the woods to starve? To the town where no right-thinking Pole would give them shelter? This camp is in the middle of nowhere. Remember that. You are in the middle of nowhere. All that gives you life is work. And my good wishes. Do you understand?" He glanced around as if daring any of them to challenge him. They were silent. "I see I have been too easy on you. I have made you into my pets. That's what they call you, you know. Boya's dirty little pets. The other transports, they don't come here and sleep in barracks and have three meals every single day. They're not cared for in a modern hospital. They're not given clothes and shoes." He held up a pair of woman's shoes, and Hannah tried not to stare at them, but they drew her eyes. "No, they are processed at once, as has been ordered from Berlin. They are part of the final solution to the Jewish problem. But you see, my little pets, I have let you live to work. And see how you reward your master.
He walked over to the violinist, who had been pushed to his knees by a guard. Pushing the man's head back, Breuer spoke directly to him, but in a voice that carried around the compound.
I let you play music because it is said that music feeds the gods. Well, now you shall feed your god.
He signaled to his men.
Move them to the wall.
There was a protesting sound from the crowd, a strange undercurrent of moaning. Hannah realized suddenly that she was one of the moaners, though she didn't know what going to the wall meant. Something awful, that she knew.
Silence, Breuer said, his voice hardly raised at all. If you are silent, I will let you watch.
They were all silent. Not, Hannah thought, because they wanted to watch, but because they wanted to be witnesses, and because they had no other choice. The guards dragged the men to a solid wall that stood next to the gate. The wall was pocked with holes and dark stains. To the right and above, the sign Arbeit macht frei swung creakingly in the wind. Birds cried out merrily from the woods, and the tops of the trees danced to rhythms all their own. The six men were lined up with their backs to the wall, four standing and two sitting. Schmoll alone smiled. Slowly the soldiers raised their guns, and Hannah bit her lip to keep from crying aloud.
Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu.
The violinist began in a clear voice. The other men at the wall joined him. But Shmuel was silent, searching through the watching crowd, that same strange smile on his face. At last his lips moved, and Hannah read the word there.
Fege. Shmuel,
came a loud wail, and Fege pushed through the crowd, flinging herself at his feet. She lifted her face to his and smiled.
The sky is our canopy, God's canopy, the sky.
He bent down and kissed the top of her head as the guns roared, a loud volley that drowned out birdsong and wind and screams. When it was silent at last, the commandant threw the shoes on top of Fage's body.
Let them all go up the stack, he said. Call the commandos, schnell.
The soldiers marched off to the side of the compound, except for one, who opened the door into Lilith's cave. Out came 10 men in green coveralls. Though she'd heard of them, feared them, mourned them, Hannah had never actually seen any of them before. One, hardly more than a boy, put his fingers to his lips, and a shrill whistle pierced the air. The commandos lifted their heads at the sound, and in mocking parody of the soldiers, marched over to the wall. They began to drag the dead bodies back toward the gate. The boy who had whistled stooped down and picked up Fege in his arms. His beardless face was grim, but there was no sign of sorrow or horror there. Still he carried Fege as one might carry a loved one, with conscious tenderness and pride. Rivka whispered to no one in particular. That one, carrying Fege. That is my brother, Wolf. The Blokova came forward, a wooden spoon in her hand, with which she dealt out blows right and left.
Schnell! Schnell! Scum! There's work to do, much work!
Her voice held a note of hysteria. The hand with the spoon didn't rest, but her other hand was held stiffly by her side. It was wrapped in a broad bandage, the white stained with fresh blood.
Gittel, Hannah said as they walked back toward the kitchen. Did you see?
I saw, Gittel said, her voice ragged. I saw everything.
I mean, did you see that Yitzhak wasn't there?
Gittel turned, took Hannah by the arms and stared at her.
Yitzhak? He wasn't there. He wasn't in the lineup either.
Hush, Gittel said, turning away, but her voice held a measure of hope.
Hush.
Hannah said no more, but in her mind's eye she saw a swift shadow racing into the dark trees. She smiled with the memory. Later that afternoon, the cauldrons all set for cooking, Hannah walked with Rivka and Shifre to the water pump. Esther was there already, filling a bucket in slow motion for the women in the sewing shop. She had lost a lot of weight. The dress hung in loose folds on her frail body. Her eyes were dead. Overhead, the swallows dipped down to catch bugs rising from the ground. Then they soared back up beyond the barracks. Hannah watched them for a moment, scarcely breathing. It was as if all nature ignored what went on in the camp. There were brilliant sunsets and soft breezes. Around the commandant's house, bright flowers were teased by the wind. Once she'd seen a fox cross the meadow to disappear into the forest. If this had been in a book, she thought, the skies would be weeping, the swallows mourning by the smokestack. Her mouth twisted at the irony of it, and she turned to the three girls at the water pump. Suddenly, with great clarity, she saw another scene superimposed upon it. Two laughing girls at a water fountain, dressed in bright blue pants and cotton sweaters. They were splashing water on each other. A bell rang to call them to class. Hannah blinked, but the image held. Drawing a deep breath, she forced herself to bring the camp back into focus. It was like turning a camera lens. One way she could see the water fountain, the other way the pump. Her heart was thudding under the thin gray dress. She was afraid to move, and then, suddenly, she made up her mind.
Listen, she said to the girls at the pump. I have a story to tell you.
A story?
Shifre looked up, her light-lashed eyes bright. You haven't told us a story since the first day. At the...
She hesitated a minute, afraid to name the memory, afraid a guard might hear and somehow steal it away.
At the wedding, Hannah said. Funny how saying it brings it back. At the wedding, at school, at home.
Tell the story, Rivka pleaded. I'd like to hear it.
For the first time, she sounded like the 10-year-old she was.
Hannah nodded.
This isn't a once-upon-a-time story, she said. This is about now and the future.
I don't want a story about now, Esther said slowly. There is too much now.
And not enough future, Shifre added.
Hannah moved close to them.
Now, 6 million Jews will die in camps like this. Die! There, I've said the word. Does it make it more real or less? And how do I know 6 million will die? I'm not sure how, but I do.
6 million, Shifre said.
That's impossible. There aren't 6 million Jews in the whole world.
6 million. Hannah said.
But that's not all the Jews there are. In the end, in the future, there will be Jews still. And there will be Israel, a Jewish state, where there will be a Jewish president and a Jewish Senate. And in America, Jewish movie stars.
I don't believe you, Esther said. Not 6 million.
You must believe me, Hannah said, because I remember...
How can you remember what hasn't happened yet? Asked Rivka.
Memory doesn't work that way, forward. It only works backward.
Yours is not a memory, it's a dream.
It's not a dream, though, Hannah said. It's as if I have three memories, one on top of another. I remember living with Gittel and Shmuel.
May he rest in peace, Rivka said.
May they all rest in peace, Hannah added.
And Lublin, put in Shifra. You remember Lublin?
Yes, there is Lublin. But that memory is like a story I've been told. I don't remember Lublin, but I remember being there. And then there's my memory of the future. It's very strong and real now, as if the more I try to remember, the more I do. Memory on memory on memory, like a layer cake.
I remember cake, Shifra said.
Impossible, Esther said.
Even crazy, Rivka pointed out.
Nevertheless, Hannah said, I remember. And you must remember too, so that whoever of us survives this place will carry the message into that future.
What message? Rivka asked, her voice breathy and low.
That we will survive. The Jews. That what happens here must never happen again, Hannah said. That four girls are talking and not working, interrupted a harsh voice.
They looked up. Standing over them was a new guard, his nose reddened from the sun. He had a strange, pleased look on his face.
I have been told that the ones who do not work are to go over there.
He pointed to the gate.
No, Rivka cried. We were working, we were.
She held up the empty bucket. The guard dismissed her pleas with a wave of his hand, and all four of them held their breath, waiting.
I was told that we need three more Jews to make up a full load. Commandant Breuer believes in efficiency, and our units do not work well with short loads. So, I was sent to find three of the commandant's pets who were not working. He told me, personally, to make up the load.
We were working,
Shifra begged, her words tumbling out in a rush.
And we're healthy. We're healthy hard workers. You never take healthy hard workers. It's one of the rules, never.
The guard smiled again.
Since Commandant Breuer makes the rules, I guess he can change the rules.
But why are you worrying so, Liebchen? I only need three.
Perhaps I won't take you.
He looked over the girl slowly, the smile still on his face.
I'll take you. You are the least healthy.
He pointed to Esther, who almost fell forward in front of him, as if someone had suddenly kicked her in the back of the knees. Shifra drew in a great loud breath and closed her eyes.
And you,
he said, playfully putting his finger on Shifra's nose, almost as if he were flirting with her.
Because you protest too much after all.
And...
Hannah let out her breath as slowly as she dared. She did nothing to call attention to herself. To stay alive one more day, one more hour, one more minute. That was all any of them thought of. It was all they could hope for. Rivka was right. What she had was not a memory, but a dream.
And you, with the babushka, like a little old lady.
I'll take you, too.
He pointed to Rivka, winked at Hannah, then turned and marched smartly toward the gate, confident that the chosen girls would follow. Rivka gave Hannah a quick hug.
Who will remember for you now?
She whispered. Hannah said nothing. The memories of Lublin and the shtetl and the camp itself suddenly seemed like the dreams. She lived, had lived, would live in the future. She, or someone with whom she shared memories. But Rivka had only now.
Without thinking through the why of it, Hannah snatched the kerchief off Rivka's head. Run, she whispered. Run to the midden. Run to the barracks. Run to the kitchen. The guard is new. He won't know the difference. One Jew is the same as another to him. Run for your life, Rivka. Run for your future. Run, run,
Run! And remember!
As she spoke, she shoved Rivka away, untied the knot of the kerchief with trembling fingers, and retied it about her own head. Then, as Rivka's footsteps faded behind her, she walked purposefully, head high, after Shifra and Esther. When she caught up with them, she put her arms around their waists as if they were three schoolgirls just walking in the yard. "Let me tell you a story," she said quietly, ignoring the fact that they were both weeping, Shifra loudly and Esther with short little gasps. "A story I know you both will love." The strength in her voice quieted them, and they began to listen even as they walked. "It's about a girl, an ordinary sort of girl named Hannah Stern, who lives in New Rochelle. Not Old Rochelle. There is no Old Rochelle, you see. Just New Rochelle. It is in an America where pictures come across a cable, moving pictures right into your living room, and..." She stopped as the dark door into Lilith's cave opened before them. "And where one day, I bet, a Jewish girl will be president if she wants to be. Are you ready now? Ready or not, here we come." Then all three of them took deep, ragged breaths and walked in through the door into endless night. Chapter 19. When the dark finally resolved itself, Hannah found she was looking across an empty hall at a green door marked 4N. "Four, for the four members of my family," Hannah thought, "and N for New Rochelle." She couldn't see Shifra or Esther anywhere. They'd slipped away without a farewell. She almost called out their names, thought better of it, and turned to look behind her. There was a large table set with a white cloth. The table was piled high with food. Matzah, roast beef, hard-boiled eggs, goblets of deep red wine. Seven adults and a little blonde boy were sitting there, their mouths opened expectantly.
"Well, Hannah," said the old man at the head of the table, "is he coming?"
Hannah turned back and looked down the long dark hall. It was still empty. "There's no one there," she whispered. "No one."
"Then come back to the table and shut the door," called out the other old man. "There's a draft. You know your Aunt Rose gets these chills."
"Sam, don't hurry the child so. She's doing her part." The woman who spoke had a plain face lit up by a special smile. "Come, sweetheart. Sit by Aunt Eva." She patted an empty chair next to her, then reached over and picked up her glass of wine.
"You look so white, Hanala, like death. How can we fix that?"
She raised her glass, looked at Hannah.
"L'chaim, to life."
She took a sip. Hannah slipped into the chair, knowing it was the one the family reserved for the prophet Elijah, who slipped through the centuries like a fish through water. She watched all the grown-ups raise their glasses.
"L'chaim."
Aunt Eva turned toward her, smiling. Her sweater was pushed back beyond her wrist. As she raised the glass again, Hannah noticed the number on her arm. J-1-8-2-0-2.
"Hanala, you're staring," whispered Aunt Eva as the talk began around the table.
Uncle Sam arguing about the price of new cars, Grandpa Will complaining about the latest government scandal, her mother asking Aunt Rose about a book. Staring. She repeated the word without understanding. Yes, at my arm. At the number. Does it frighten you still? You've never let me explain it to you, and your mother hates me to talk of it. Still, if you want me to... Hannah touched the number on her aunt's arm with surprising gentleness, whispering, No. No, please. Let me explain it to you. For a moment she was silent. Then she said, J is for Jew. And one because you were alone. Alone of the eight who had been in your family. Though two is the actual number of them alive. Your brother was a commando, one of the Jews forced to tend the ovens, to handle the dead, so he thought he was a zero. She looked up at Eva, who was staring at her. Oh, your brother, Grandpa Will. That must have been him carrying Fega. So that's why... And Eva closed her eyes for a moment, as if thinking... or remembering. Then she whispered back, His name was Wolf. Wolf. And the irony of it was that he was as gentle as a lamb. He changed his name when we came to America. We all changed our names. To forget. Remembering was too painful. But to forget was impossible. Her coffee-brown eyes opened again. Go on, child. Hannah took her hand from her aunt's arm and dropped it into the safety of her own lap. She couldn't look at her aunt anymore. That familiar, unfamiliar, plain, beautiful face. You said
that when things were over... You would be two again, forever. J, one, eight, two, oh, two.
They sat for a long moment in silence, while the talk and laughter at the table dipped and soared about them like swallows. At last, Hannah looked up. Her aunt was staring at her, as if really seeing her for the first time.
Aunt Eva.
Hannah began, and Eva's hand touched her on the lips firmly, as if to stop her mouth from saying what had to be said. In my village, in the camp, in the past, Eva said, I was called... Rivka. Hannah nodded and took her aunt's fingers from her lips. She said, in a voice much louder than she had intended, so loud that the entire table hushed at its sound,
I remember. Oh, I remember.
Epilogue. Aunt Eva told Hannah the end of the story much later, when the two of them were alone, because no one else would ever have believed them. She said that of all the villagers young Chaya had come to the camp with that spring, only two were alive at the end of the war. Yitzhak, who had indeed escaped, had lived in the forest with the partisans, fighting the Germans. And Gittel. When the camp had been liberated in 1945, Gittel weighed only 73 pounds because she had insisted on sharing her rations with the children. But she was alive. The Blokova and all the villagers from Vyosk were dead. But among the living, besides Gittel, Yitzhak, and Rivka, were Leah and her baby, a solemn 3-year-old. Gittel and Yitzhak had emigrated to Israel, where they lived, close friends until well into their 70s. Neither of them ever married. Yitzhak became a politician, a member of the Israeli Senate, the Knesset. Gittel, known throughout the country as Tante Gittel and Gittel the Bear, organized a rescue mission dedicated to salvaging the lives of young survivors and locating the remnants of their families. It later became an adoption agency, the finest in the Mideast. She called it after her young niece, who had died a hero in the camps. Chaya. Life.
The End. You've been listening to The Devil's Arithmetic by Jane Yolen, narrated by Barbara Rosenblatt. The author closes with the following note.
What is true about this book? Although the Stern Seder is not strictly a traditional one, it is a mirror of the Seders my family used to hold. My Uncle Louis was the one who always said, "And how do I know? Because I was there," while hiding the Afikoman in plain sight under his chair for the youngest to find and hide again. The word Seder literally means order, but my family's religious life was not an orderly one. Like many American Jews, it was one of rough-and-tumble choices and lots of love. We were Jews because we were born Jewish, not because of following strict rules. When I had to memorize Hebrew and history for my confirmation, I continually complained how tired I was of remembering. However, there is an orderly progress to a Seder that a perusal of its guidebook, the Haggadah, will show to the curious reader. All the facts about the horrible routinization of evil in the camps is true. The nightmare journeys in cattle cars, the shaving of heads, the tattooing of numbers, the separation of families, the malnutrition, the Muslimmen and the commandos, the lack of proper clothing, the choosing of the victims for incineration. Even the midden pile comes from the camp experiences of one of my friends. Only the characters are made up. Chaya, Gittel, Shmuel, Rivka, and the rest, though they are made up of the bits and pieces of true stories that got brought out by the pitiful handful of survivors. The unnamed camp I have written about did not exist. Rather, it is an amalgam of the camps that did. Auschwitz, with its ironic sign, Arbeit macht frei, was the worst of them, where in 2.5 years, 2 million Jews and 2 million Soviet prisoners of war, Polish political prisoners, gypsies, and European non-Jews were gassed. Treblinka, where 840,000 Jews were killed. Chelmno, with its total of 360,000 Jews. Sobibor, with its 250,000. There were other camps, and their count is the devil's arithmetic indeed. Belzec, Majdanek, Dachau, Birkenau, Bergen-Belsen, Buchenwald, Mauthausen, Ravensbrück. The toll is endless and anonymous. Whole families, whole villages, whole countrysides disappeared. At the time of the Holocaust, it seemed impossible to imagine, for the scale of slaughter was difficult to grasp. Today, a lifetime later, we can echo Winston Churchill, who wrote, "There is no doubt that this is probably the greatest and most horrible single crime ever committed in the whole history of the world." And yet it is still impossible, unimaginable, difficult to grasp. Even with the facts in front of us, the numbers, the indelible photographs, the autobiographies, the wrists still bearing the long numbers, there are people in the world who deny such things actually happened. After all, how can we believe that human beings like ourselves, mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, could visit upon their fellow humans such programmed misery, such a routine of torture, all couched in the language of manufacture? So many units delivered, operating at full capacity. These were not camps, even though they were called so. These were factories designed for the effective murder of human beings. There is no way that fiction can come close to touching how truly inhuman, alien, even satanic, was the efficient machinery of death at the camps. Nor how heroism had to be counted, not in resistance, which was worse than useless because it meant involving the deaths of even more innocents. Not to act, Emanuel Ringelblum, a Jewish historian of the Holocaust, has written, not to lift a hand against the Germans had become the quiet, passive heroism of the common Jew. That heroism, to resist being dehumanized, to simply outlive one's tormentors, to practice the quiet, everyday caring for one's equally tormented neighbors, to witness, to remember. These were the only victories of the camps. Fiction cannot recite the numbing numbers, but it can be that witness, that memory. A storyteller can attempt to tell the human tale, can make a galaxy out of the chaos, can point to the fact that some people survived, even as most people died, and can remind us that the swallows still sing around the smokestacks.
This book is copyrighted 1988 by Jane Yolen. This recording is copyrighted 1996 by Recorded Books. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The House of Dyes Drear by Virginia Hamilton, narrated by Lynn Thigpen. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of this book. You can order by phone, with any major credit card, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.